For the week of December 15th, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 472, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Greentown, Pennsylvania, I'm Michael Gills.
What's in Greentown, Pennsylvania?
A lake.
Okay, I hope you're not swimming because it is in the Northern Hemisphere. What we refer to as winter.
It is cool, and there's come a snowstorm coming tomorrow, so I am visiting my brother's new house in Greentown, Pennsylvania, getting ready to jump in a rental car a little earlier than expected and head on down to Birmingham, Alabama for the holidays. And in fact,
so you're a storm chaser. You're a storm chaser. You've become a storm chaser.
I'm a storm runner-aware is really what I am.
Okay.
I'm trying to get away from the storm. And I'm going to be down in Alabama, and it looks like I'll be down there for quite a while to come.
Will you be voting in the next election down there? Said the guy who, you know, thinks maybe, you know, if you were down there, maybe, you know, it would change the demographic in Alabama.
I haven't figured all that out yet, though. I may need to. I'm going down to help look after my mom, spend time with her. She's turning 91 in February. She's doing great. You know, she's still driving. And the only way to take that car out of her hands is for me to move down there and become her driver. Otherwise, she will just keep driving. So I'm going to go head down.
So wait a second. You're going to Alabama to star in Driving Miss Guilt.
Exactly. I will be Hoke. Yet one more example of white appropriation.
My condolences to Mrs. Guilt.
Yeah. So, no, that's it. So for the next quite a few years, I will be down in Birmingham, Alabama, vast majority of the time. I am moving to Birmingham.
Well, you know, what's funny is...
You didn't know that.
I did not know that, actually. I'm finding out, along with you listeners, right now. However, I was just in New York City. And I know what you're going to say, Michael.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thanks for
saying hi and having coffee. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I was actually there for all of a raging 24 hours.
Proving yet again, we are not friends.
I was like, I should call Michael. And then I realized, oh, I'm basically going from the airport to the hotel... to the event, back to the hotel, back to the airport.
You're in good company. That's what one of my brothers and one of my sisters did in the last 3 weeks. So,
really?
Oh, I'm too busy. I'm here very shortly, just a week. I don't have any time.
A week?
No,
a week.
A day.
Yeah. That said, one of the things, I was around a lot of other people in the media business, mm-hmm. and they were all lamenting, or commenting, I should say, on how they are spread all over the country now, that the head office, the newsroom, so to speak, has become virtual. There really is very little need for a newsroom.
Everyone to sit together in one spot, yeah.
Right. If you're the New York Times, the LA Times, yeah, you have a newsroom of some kind. If you're the Guardian, likewise. But that they are, like all of their... especially in the arts and entertainment and technology sections, they're all over the place working from home or on the road. So technically, for what you do as an entertainment journalist, it doesn't really matter.
That's right. We'll be continuing to do the show throughout the years with the same plugged-in nature. And in fact, next week, there will be a show on Christmas Eve we'll record on Monday, December 23rd, and we think New Year's Eve as well. December 30th. So we're hoping to have shows for the next 2 weeks because there will be a lot of box office, even if not a lot of news. Maybe the shows will be shorter. We'll find out what happens in the next 2 weeks. But what's going to happen right now?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we cover the usual stuff with our usual flair. We hope. We assume. I don't know. Anyway, the holiday season is heating up and everyone wants a gift. Harvey Weinstein insists he's really a hero to women. Really. You know, and really that speaks for itself. We won't say any more than that, but Orlando Jones has Gabriel Union on speed dial, and we'll explain why that is. Plus, Cineworld just bought itself an early Christmas gift, the Canadian chain Cineplex.
And it fits.
Yes, by the way, I can tell you, every once in a while, you know, you wake up in the middle of the night and you check your phone just to see what time it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I did that last night. Worst mistake ever.
What?
Because as I picked it up, I was like, what? Wait, Cineworld? I was like, I got to put my glasses on for this. This can't be true. What? Cineworld is buying 2.1 billion. What the? Yeah, needless to say, didn't go back to sleep. It was 4:30 in the morning. But in any case, in China, the government has pivoted from censoring basketball to shooting protesters in Hong Kong to getting upset about soccer players. You know, it's all in a good day's work. You know, it's a losing battle, but China can't afford to win either. On Inside Baseball, we'll dive into all the awards season nonsense and see what surfaces when it comes to Oscar hopefuls. You know, sure thing, Michael, I don't think we're going to get nominated.
Well,
yeah, I don't think so. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's box office.
That's right. We're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. That's our base. That's our dough. And then we mix in all the other stuff and all the other information we can find. Box office profit, box office mojo, deadline, the numbers, Hollywood Reporter, Variety, The Times, The LA Times, you name it. The number one movie around the world last week was Jumanji, The Next Level. $160 million worldwide now that it's opened up in North America and some other territories. It's at $212 million and counting. This puppy's going to be just fine.
You know, so this movie, I mean, yeah. I mean, it's just good.
Well, it didn't do great in China.
Who knew? Who knew? I would, when I heard that they were remaking Jumanji, I was just like, yeah, that's not going to work. But, you know, again, I was saying that just kind of like flippantly without reading the script or knowing who was starring in it. And yeah, I was wrong.
And of course, it did not work in China. They bum rushed it into theaters a week early. That did not help it there. But everywhere else, it's doing pretty good. At number two around the world is Frozen 2, another $113 million worldwide. It has passed the $1 billion mark and still going strong. It's $1.03 billion. It will certainly, it looks like, match the $1.3 billion of Frozen 1.
At number that makes it the 12th movie this year that Disney has released that has earned $1 billion.
Not 12.
I'm kidding around.
Six is big enough.
Yeah.
At number three is Knives Out. $38 million on the weekend, $162 million worldwide. Assuming everyone just did this for love and not money, that budget of $40 million means that this sucker is well profitable. At number four is a new film in China. It's called Sheep Without a Shepherd. It's a crime drama of some sort, and it opened up quite strongly with $30 million.
I would love to know the story behind that title. You know, I want to see the movie just to see like when somebody turns around and has the monologue about how when they were a kid, they had to tend to the sheep, but then they left and then the sheep were, you know, whatever it is that gives that film its title.
Well, the idea might be the dad because it's an attempted, brutal attempted rape. And then the person is killed to stop them. And of course, I assume it looks like that person is some sort of one percenter and the family is poor. So they must hide the fact that they've killed him, even though he's a brutal rapist. And, you know, they were just protecting themselves. And the whole family seems to get involved and the dad is there. And I think he gets arrested. This is all in the trailer. And so it looks like the family are the sheep without the shepherd, with their dad who has sort of helped them try and get away with this. And that seems to be the plot of the film. As much as I can gather, my Chinese is not so strong.
I was going to say, I'm almost sorry I asked after you. You
well, there's another Chinese film right behind that. It's called Skyfire. It looks like a volcano has burst. It's a disaster flick of some sort. A volcano is exploding and they want to get out of the way. It opened to $20 million. We haven't seen either of these films. And if you have and know anything about them, like their budgets, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us. The email to send your missives off to is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call as well. You can leave us a voicemail. We might even play it on the show. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, we're on Twitter. Our handle is @showbizsandbox. Or we're on Facebook. Facebook.com/showbizsandbox is where you can like our page.
That's right. At number six around the world, if you go to our page and look at our notes, you will find, that's Facebook. If you go to our showbizsandbox.com page, you'll find a link of showing you all these movies and what they've grossed. So if our numbers come at you fast and furious, you'll be able to catch up. And speaking of racing, Ford versus Ferrari is at number six on the list. It grossed $17 million. It's at $184 million worldwide. It's getting,
you know, I took my daughter to see this film.
Did
and
you?
Yes, and I was worried. I was like, is it appropriate?
Certainly nothing inappropriate. It's an old-fashioned movie, for sure.
And she said, how come we couldn't see Frozen 2 or Jumanji? And I said, look, your sister's at a sleepover. You know, she's going to want to see those movies. It would be kind of wrong for me to take one of you without the other. So let's go see this other movie that I want to see. and she was just, I can't believe we have to go see this movie. And then she came back, that was a good movie. That was a really good movie.
Oh, I'm so glad. That's awesome. What did you think?
I thought, it was a pretty good movie. you know, for what it was trying to do.
What was it trying? It was trying to be a good movie. What else is it trying to do?
Yeah, I'm sure you hated it.
No, I thought it was solid.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, okay. I thought it was a solid, good old-fashioned movie, no doubt. It was just a good movie. I thought the kid was great. The kid from Jojo Rabbit, who plays his son.
Ah, okay. Yes, yes.
Yeah, Christian Bale's son. What's the
Peter?
Noah Jupe.
Or okay, however he's also in a whole bunch of other stuff too. And
well, he was in A Quiet Place. He was in Suburbicon and Wonder, but that was Wonder was not a good film. But he was in the TV miniseries The Night Manager. But certainly, you know, Jojo Rabbit and I'm sorry, not Jojo Rabbit. Honey Boy is what I meant to say. He's in Honey
that's
Boy.
That's where
he's
I knew
the lead in Honey Boy and the supporting in Ford versus Ferrari. It's a great year for him.
The whole time I was thinking to myself, I know that kid from somewhere. I know that kid from somewhere. I know that. And sure enough, it was Honey Boy. That's where I recognize him from.
Yeah. And he was terrific. Very good in both films. And number seven around the world is Last Christmas. $16 million it made, and it has now hit the magical $100 million mark. The budget was only $25 million, so it's another win for Emma Thompson. At number eight is another Chinese film. It's Gone with the Light. It looks like some sort of mysterious M. Night Shyamalan type film. Something has happened. That's all I can gather from the trailer. Something has happened. And it made $9 million on its opening week. And then we have a run of about six movies, all of which made $5 to $7 million. Black Christmas is a slasher remake that opened up here in North America. Queen and Slim is chugging along. That's at $33 million and counting. The Wild Goose Lake is a Chinese crime drama, sort of a B movie with a little bit on its mind. That made another $7 million. It's at $27 million in China. A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, the Mr. Rogers film, that's just passing $50 million. The Addams Family opened up in some new territory. It looks like it's going to hit $200 million, which is great considering its modest budget. Joker is chugging along. And then at the bottom of this list of movies grossing $5 to $7 million is Clint Eastwood's Richard Jewell. That movie opened up to $5 million in North America, which is like the lowest amount for a Clint Eastwood film in like 30 years, 40. I mean, it's been a really long time since one of his movies has not at least clicked enough to open up.
Well, you didn't see the movie.
I have not seen the film, and it is not because of the mini media controversy about how one character is depicted. This is strictly people just were not interested.
It doesn't
happen a lot with Clint Eastwood. He really is a dependable commercial filmmaker for sure. He's not in this film. That doesn't help a little bit, but he tends to deliver. But, you know, he didn't do great with Jersey Boys. But this one, he couldn't even wave his hand and get any attention whatsoever. Kind of hard. There's sort of some good performances in it, according to other people like Kathy Bates. But there you go.
No, the controversy. Do you want to explain what the controversy is?
Not really. There's most of the characters. Well, Richard Jewell, obviously, and his mother are real people. FBI agents and others are composites, so they're not the names of real people. But there's a reporter from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution who is depicted in the film. She died, so they used her real name. She's died at like the age of 40. So they used her real name. She's the one who broke the story, saying that this guy who had found the bomb during the Olympic bombing, this guy became a hero. But he found it, and so then the FBI started to investigate him as perhaps the person who placed it. That's kind of pro forma. But the FBI also, the implication is, did want to sort of paint him as the guy they thought was the bad guy. So she ran with the story, huge thing, and that became a huge scandal. And when it turned out that the guy was not even remotely guilty and had been painted as this loser, you know, bombing fanatic, well, you know, he paid a heavy, heavy price for that. And that it was a travesty, a miscarriage. They went too far with the information that they had. All of the media did. It became a circus. But that reporter is shown sleeping with John Hamm, the FBI agent, in order to get that scoop. And there's not a scintilla of evidence that that happened. She didn't do it. Even though if you watch Fox News, they say, oh, female reporters do that all the time. That's literally a quote on the air that, oh, women always sleep around to get their stories. It's an old, ugly, you know, lie about journalists and women, and it's not true. So at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, they're like, she's dead. She can't defend herself. That's not true. And whatever miscarriage of justice happened with the treatment of this Richard Jewell, there's no reason for you to compound that by doing the same thing to her.
Yeah, I figured it was worth mentioning that because there's another film, Bombshell, where there is, you know, two characters are real, mm-hmm. and we all know them.
Many our characters are real. What are you talking about?
Two of the female characters.
Three of them, plus, you know, Roger Ailes.
Well, Margot. Well, yes, I was talking about the female character. Sorry, I should have prefaced that. And the third one is an amalgam, and it's getting some flack for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's always difficult. The one complaint I've heard about Bombshell is that it's too soon, and so you don't have any perspective, and so they're sort of not able to really nail it down. But other people have really liked those performances by the women and John Lithgow, so I'm kind of looking forward to seeing it. But that's Richard Jewell, a rare commercial flop opening weekend for Clint Eastwood. Not all of his movies make money, but damn near most of them do, and they almost always open up. But this movie just didn't work. And it seemed like it would, because you get to paint both the deep state FBI and the liberal media as bad guys. I thought that would have been red meat for his traditional audience, because he certainly skews older and conservative. But that didn't happen here. On the other hand, Dark Waters, the Mark Ruffalo film talking about the crimes that DuPont has done, well, that opened up very modestly. It made $4 million on the weekend. It's at $9 million and counting. Right below that is 21 Bridges. And then at the very bottom is an Italian hilarious time travel comedy called The First Christmas. That's from two guys, Ficarro and Piccone, who are a comic duo. They work on stage and TV and books. They've made movies. This one, one of them is a priest. The other one tries to steal like a baby Jesus out of a nativity for some reason. And they end up running into a cornfield, which I guess is a link to a Field of Dreams. And suddenly they've gone back to, you know, zero. In the common era, it's the birth of Jesus, and they're there for the first Christmas. It's hilarious.
I could just see. I was just gonna say, I could see the trailer. One of them's a thief. One of them's a priest.
Right. 40 years ago, it would have been Cheech and Chong smoking pot and ending back in the first nativity. Now it's two hapless Italian fellows. But it opened to $3 million in Italy.
Mamma mia!
But one other movie is not on the charts, and that is The Irishman. Netflix wants us to believe that 26 million people have watched The Irishman in its first 7 days.
And what I will tell you is 26 million people did indeed start watching The Irishman.
Well, they claim, you know, historically, in the last few months or whatever, they say we only say somebody watched it if they watched 70% of the film or 70% of the first episode of a series. So that would mean you would have had to watch at least like, what, 2.5 hours, 2 hours and 40 minutes before they would say, OK, yes, you have officially watched The Irishman, to which I say, OK, 26 million people. But how many of them were napping?
You know, when I went to see Ford versus Ferrari, which, you know, has a lot of loud revving engines.
Yeah, and it's 2 hours, but it's long. It's like 2 hours and 20 minutes or something.
2 hours, 32 minutes.
Oh, OK. Yeah.
There was a person behind me snoring. I mean,
I don't know how they do it.
I was like, wait, is that a car engine? No, it's actually somebody snoring. They fell asleep in the movie theater.
I've told the story before about seeing noises off in London during its opening run, one of the great farces of all time. It was a rare part of London where there was air conditioning. They had air conditioning in the theater where we were attending this live performance. Lady came in next to us. It was a hot, hot day. Sat down, fell promptly asleep. This is one of the loudest, funniest comedies of all time. The audience is roaring. She slept through the entire show, woke up and started applauding at the very end, you know. She's like, oh, well done, well done.
That's pretty much exactly like our political system these days.
Yeah, there you go. So speaking of politics, bigger is better, and nobody is going to block a merger. So I assume the purchase of Cineplex, the Canadian chain by UK's Cineworld, will go through all over the world. No one's going to throw a roadblock in front of this thing. And this would make Regal, at least in North America, the largest exhibitor in North America.
Yes. And it's really Cineworld. Okay, so Cineworld is an amalgam of CineCity.
It's a big multinational corporation with tons of theater chains all over the world.
Right. Then they, you know, Cineworld is out of the UK. They bought Regal a year or two ago. Mm-hmm. And now they're buying Cineplex, which is Canada's largest movie theater chain. It has 75% of the market. There's Landmark Theaters, not the Landmark that we all know, not Landmark Cinemas. Very confusing, I know. But Landmark Theaters is also in Canada. They are owned by a group out of Belgium now, Kinoplex.
All right. So, but worldwide, how many theater screen? Was it screens or locations, hardtops? What will they have?
I think it's 11,200 screens, not hard tops. Okay. Not
so if you've
locations.
Got 10 screens at your theater, that's 10.
Correct.
Okay. That's a lot though, right? Who's bigger?
Is it AMC with Wanda?
Yeah.
And, you know,
I think they're the biggest.
They are the biggest. Now here's the rub. And this is where things start to kind of get a little numbery. Okay.
Oh, the bottom line you're is, so happy. I knew you'd be happy about this deal, but I didn't know how happy.
I'm not necessarily happy about this deal.
Oh, I mean, I don't that you could talk about it.
Oh, well, I don't know about that. I prefer not to wake up at 4:30 in the morning to find out about it.
Do you think it's bad for business?
You know, if the Paramount decree, I had to throw it in there because
sure.
of that.
Ka-ching.
Yeah, 25 cents for me. But basically what's going to happen now, if the Paramount decree does, and that consent decree does get thrown out and basically turned off, then block booking will surely become a thing, which means you have these huge media conglomerates that can then put pressure on all of these theater operators. The only thing to combat that is a larger theater operator. The problem, of course, with that is all of these independents will be crushed. Mm-hmm. But that aside, you have AMC, and it's AMC, Odeon, owned by Wanda. But AMC is technically a separate company. And ever since the money from China got really, it got turned off, mm-hmm. like in a big, big way. They had to refinance their debt because there was no way they could repay the loans that they, you know, leveraged to buy all of these things, Carmike and Odeon, mm-hmm. Within the 5-year time span. So they refinanced earlier this year, but their share price is around $8, 8.5, you know, $8
compared to where was it before the takeover,
which was like 30. So now
they've fallen in debt because they've been burdened with debt by this outside company.
Right. And so a lot of people were wondering, wait a second, can Cineworld really do this? Can Cineworld, basically, this is a leveraged buyout. This is all being done through debt mm-hmm. for the most part. And Cineworld is paying a premium of about $10. And so, you know, they're paying $34 a
Are they
share.
Overburdened with debt before this deal? Because it was just 2 years
That's
ago that
the
they
thing.
Spent about $3 billion in order to acquire Regal.
Apparently, their debt ratio upon completion will be 4x. Not bad. I mean, 5 to 6x, you're beginning to be concerned. And their hope is that upon completion, by 2021, that will be down to 3x, which is not bad. Mm-hmm. What that means is it will take 3 years at their current earnings to pay back all of the loans, if that's what they decided to do. That's actually not too bad at all. Mm-hmm. So maybe they're managing their money correctly. Certainly their margins are up there and their earnings are up there, whereas AMC has been struggling in all of those categories to a point where they went into Europe and let many of the managing directors of the individual firms that they purchased, they let them go. And these are people that have been in the business for decades. It shocked everybody.
Well, you love numbers. I love movies. And in looking over this story, the head of Cineworld said, hey, I know everyone is worried about 2020. The cupboard is bare. We're not going to have a new Avengers film. What will we do? There won't be any movies. It's all going to be so down. Again, number one, as far as the studios are concerned, it doesn't matter if they release 40 films instead of 60 films, but they all make them for the right price and they're profitable. That's a success story, right? They made movies that people wanted to see. In terms of theater chains, of course, they need product 365 days a year to fill seats so they can sell popcorn, right? So he said, again, like everybody else, like you've been saying, oh my God, 2020, there's nothing coming out. My God.
I haven't been saying that. I've been saying that's what the industry
right.
is saying.
Right. So I looked at the list. And okay. Of course, Star Wars comes out Thursday. We're recording on a Monday. Star Wars comes out Thursday, but it will have 15 days in the theater where it could make $1 billion before it's 2020. But it will have the tail end of Star Wars. You'll have weeks of Star Wars plus 1917 and Little Women. Then you've got, as far as franchises and big movies, things to look forward to: James Bond, Wonder Woman, two Marvel films, Black Widow and The Eternals, two Pixar films, which includes Soul and Onward, which has Chris Pratt and Tom Holland. You have a Christopher Nolan film, a new Bad Boys film, Dr. Dolittle with Robert Downey Jr., Harley Quinn gets her own spinoff, A Quiet Place 2, Godzilla vs. Kong, the live-action Mulan, Legally Blonde 3, Fast and Furious 9, which tends to be a billion-dollar franchise, Artemis Fowl is launching a new series, a new spinoff of Scooby-Doo, Top Gun Maverick. Here's one I think is really going to be big, the In the Heights musical by Lin-Manuel Miranda. There's a huge passionate desire to see his stuff, the stuff that he has created, and most people haven't. All they've heard is the album. You know, you feel like that show is so big. Hamilton, everybody's seen it. In the Heights had a great long run. It's one of the longest running hits in Broadway history. This is a film with a Latino flair. It is a great musical. It's very, you know, fun and entertaining. I just saw the trailer. That's going to be a big movie.
I can tell you that they showed a huge, long featurette at both CinemaCon and Cine Europe. It looked really good. People were like, kind of, as soon as the featurette was over, it's like an extended trailer, like 5, 6, 7 minutes. People were kind of murmuring among themselves, wait a second, that thing looks pretty good.
That's going to be a big, long winner. A new Minions, Ryan Reynolds has a film, Free Guy, it's sort of a spin on VR. Ghostbusters Afterlife, I thought that trailer looked pretty cool. Jungle Cruise with Dwayne Johnson, who's generally Money in the Bank. The Return of Bill and Ted, a sequel to Kingsman called The King's Man. Death on the Nile, a Halloween sequel. Vivo, a Sony animated musical with songs, all brand new songs, by Lin-Manuel Miranda. Red Notice, an action flick with Ryan Reynolds and Dwayne Johnson and Gal Gadot. King Richard with Will Smith playing the father of Serena and Venus. That's more of a, you know, drama, whatever, but still, it's Will Smith, and I think it's going to be really interesting. Another Disney animated film, Raya and the Last Dragon, West Side Story, Coming to America 2, Dune, The Croods 2, and a great Tom Hanks film based on a great novel called News of the World. Those are just stuff that I have noticed. Obviously, some of them won't be great. King Kong versus Godzilla looks like it, you know, that's a franchise that's very troubled. It could crash and burn. Dr. Doolittle could be dumb. Who knows? But I'm not actually worried and being kept up at night thinking there won't be any movies that can be hits.
Well, The Croods 2, okay, I think, and I'm not going to go through these one by one, but The Croods 2, if it plays as well as The Croods plays on DVD and streaming, people love this movie.
Yep.
It's one of those things that it may not have made $1 trillion at the box office.
But it had a big afterlife.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Yeah.
Much like Jumanji did, by the way.
Well, that's why it's opening Christmas. You know, it's opening right in the heart of December. So, you know, they know, and it made up $580 million worldwide. So it was hardly a bummer. It certainly was profitable. And, you know, it's well positioned, as you, I'm sure they looked at the numbers and said, wow, not only did this movie make money, but boy, people love it. Bring it on. Yeah, no, there's lots of examples of this. Obviously, some of them won't work, but there's a lot of movies, some of which are not clear-cut slam dunks, like In the Heights, that could be really, really big and come out of nowhere. I'm putting that in quotes. So we'll have to see, but I am not looking at that list and thinking, wow, nothing's coming out.
Yeah, I mean, West Side Story could easily make $600-700 million.
Spielberg, of course, yeah. And, you know, two Marvel movies, two Pixar films, another Disney animated film, you know, James Bond, Wonder Woman, you know.
If the Pixar film Soul is as good as the featurette they showed, it's going to be really good.
Yeah, no, well, they often are, and the trailer looks great, and the trailer for Onward looked interesting. No, so there's a lot of interesting movies, and I agree with the guy from Cineworld. We're going to be just fine.
You know who's not going to be just fine?
China.
Yeah, you know, what is, I mean, we're not going to get political here.
Well, I will.
Okay, well, I'm just, you know, what we're trying to do is figure out how is the entertainment industry being affected. And by the way, entertainment does include sports, as, you know, the I can't remember the two boxers who, last week or it's coming up, where basically they said, one of the boxers said, and this was for a world championship, a heavyweight championship, they said, you know, we're willing to go into the ring and nearly kill one another and really risk our lives to entertain people. So sports is effectively entertainment.
That's why I don't like boxing. Well, here's the problem. China has really backed itself into a corner. You know, we had the issues with basketball, which led people to, of course, launch protests at basketball games all over the world. So now they have to sort of black out basketball and put a time delay on it to make sure that they don't inadvertently reveal stuff to their own people about protests, about their behavior. But now they've done it with football, aka soccer. An Arsenal football player posted a comment on Twitter on his own saying he supported the Muslims that China is brutally treating. And now China's like, well, we're not going to show that game and you need to shut him. It's like, you can't tell every athlete in the world to shut up. And if they're going to ban every game or every sport where any player ever expresses any political views that they don't like, they're simply not going to be able to air any sports whatsoever. No baseball, no. And you know what? If I'm a fan or I'm a person who takes politics seriously, guess what I'm starting to do? You know, if I'm actually awake and care about this stuff and I'm a football player or a baseball player or a soccer player, I'm going to start using my feet. So, oh, yeah? right? So what is China going to do? Ban all sports? They can. But
well, I guess my question is this. Do they have in China, I guess it doesn't matter because a lot of these networks are state-owned, if not all of them. Does it matter if they don't show sports? Can they just say it doesn't matter whether you're profitable?
It's less like movies. You can block all Hollywood films. They certainly, you know, Richard Gere hasn't had a career. It worked with him. If studios are scared and run in the other direction, you can affect what studios do. They will censor themselves and they will stop working with actors that you don't like. If you make it clear to them, put that guy in your film, we will not show it. So that can work when the studios get scared. But when they start targeting everyone, they're going to block any film, any TV show, any sports team because of the comments of anyone associated with the team in any way, shape, or form. Then they're just creating a lot of problems for themselves. And they look weak.
Yeah. Although, you know, there was the issue in basketball where the general manager...
Well, that was a general manager. Yeah, but now we're talking about a player on Arsenal. Like, an individual player, they think that no player is going to ever be able to speak on politics ever again. That's not how it works, China. You know, that just isn't. And so every actor, every movie... It works with Richard Gere. They crippled his career, truly. Not that he wasn't well on in his years, etc. But, I mean, nobody was hiring him for years for anything.
So, and this is because he spoke out against Tibet.
Absolutely. So,
well, not against Tibet, but for Tibet.
Right. So that can work when studios panic and get scared. But if you say, sorry, we don't actually have that power in order to stop all people from having a political opinion. Sorry, China. And if you just make the best movie you can, if they don't want to show it, you're going to have to just deal with that. But that's going to be more of a problem for China than it will be for the rest of the world.
Well, because in the rest of the world, the sports will continue. They will be televised in various parts of the world. And if they're not televised in China, as long as China pays the fee.
Right. But when we're talking about movies, you know, they need Hollywood films. They need them for their box office. There's no way they can create the whole box office just by themselves. They have a ton of screens. They want to fill them with people. They need Hollywood. So Hollywood just needs to recognize that it's in the driver's seat. They're not going to be pushing them around and telling them what to do, but they're just saying, sorry, we can't actually censor freedom of speech just because you don't like it. So if they would be less scared and more proactive and just say, yeah, no, that's not how that works, buddy, sorry, they would realize how much power they have, not China.
And they're going to have you deliver that message. You know,
I will do it via Skype.
Okay.
Oh my gosh, I forgot to write our first big deal, big whoop story up. Oh dear me.
Well, I'm just going to wing it. Okay. And since actually you just mentioned big deal or big whoop, it's time for big deal or big whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Here's our first story, which was not written, so I will wing it. And it is about the Broadway musical Beetlejuice.
I will not say,
but you know what? I don't think it works if I say it once and you say it twice.
Oh, so saying. It's only if I say Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. All right. Keep going.
Yep. Nope. Didn't work. Now, here's what I will say. In the 24 hours that I was in New York City, I landed at JFK, walked through American Airlines Terminal, which, by the way, Disney has a huge takeover for all of its films. And this month, it was Star Wars. It was pretty immersive, I must say. But then you kind of rise up to the main terminal, and there is... You want to talk about, you could say Beetlejuice 900 times. The whole main terminal was taken over by Beetlejuice promos.
Oh, interesting.
And yet, it is closing its run in June of 2020.
Well, Beetlejuice was one of the big success stories of the last season. It opened okay, struggled a little bit, turned it around with a Tony Awards performance. It opened the show. It was clever lyrics. We thought it was the best performance of the show. It really helped get the word out. They changed their marketing campaign. They tweaked it from like, we're subversive to we're fun. And that worked. Right. And that's, you know, that's what the show is. Anyway, it's not like they're misleading people, but they built and built and built. Word of mouth went well. The Tony performance became the most watched clip from the Tony Awards. So everything came together, new marketing campaign. There was always a sort of a core interest in it, and it built and built and became a success. Over $1 million a week, every week. It was really turning it around. It just set a box office record. And that's at the space where Cats played for 1,000 years. That tells you what new ticket prices are doing.
The Winter Garden Theater.
Yeah, it's a massive space. But when you get to raise prices like we do today, you can do that sort of thing. So they really had turned it around, created a family-friendly hit. They were bringing in new theatergoers who don't often go to Broadway. It was sort of that sort of gate, you know, what do you call it? Gateway drug for Broadway. It was new people were coming to see a Broadway show for the first time, and it was Beetlejuice. Everything worked. And this show cost $21 million to make. They really made it happen. But then the theater owner said, yeah, you got to get out by June.
And they said, so basically, I don't have my sound effect of the record scratching across. Yeah. It's just like, wait, what?
Right. And it continues to grow at the box office. And its advance is $7.6 million and growing. It's like doubled over the last certain months. So everything is in the right direction to be a long-running, ongoing hit. However, early on, it had dropped below certain contractual. If you drop below a certain level for 2 weeks in a row, the theater owners can say, yeah, you're a flop. Get out. They have that right forever. If you just do it at any point, then they get to hold on to that right and say, we can play our chip whenever we want and say, you have to get out. If you never drop below certain contractually agreed levels, you're fine. They can't kick you out because you're a big hit. So that helps you give you a little power. But almost every show has that at some point, you know, unless it's a real phenomenon. And in this case, they had that ability to kick him out, and they're doing it because they want The Music Man with Hugh Jackman. That's coming.
That's a silly move on in my opinion, because The Music Man with Hugh Jackman
will run a year.
Yes, correct. Exactly. And then it'll be done.
But they believe they can bring in someone else. Music Man is a show where you can easily bring in a new star. But yeah, no one will match Hugh Jackman. But they do believe you could bring in Matthew Broderick, who did it before, you know, or you could bring in somebody new to do it. And that would be another big star, just like, you know, Hello Dolly. They kept that running after Bette Midler left. Nobody matched Bette Midler, but they had a good run. So they want the Hugh Jackman film. Everybody tried to, okay.
Film, you mean
musical, yeah.
Musical,
so they said, all right, what if we move To Kill a Mockingbird? That's a Scott Rudin. We'll move that, and then Scott Rudin can move Beetlejuice into the place where To Kill a Mockingbird is, and the people doing Music Man will pay. It's like, they tried all these different shenanigans, and it didn't pay out. But the result, like you say, is not a win-win. And the big problem here is not the big bad landlord. The problem is there are so few spaces available on Broadway. They need more black box theaters so shows can be flexible and produced any way you want. And they need more houses because shows are running for 4, 5, 6, 7 years. And that just locks them down for so long that you get desperate and you kick out a show that's doing well in order to make room for another show you know is a surefire hit for 1 year. But I'm with you. I think Music Man is a slam dunk for a season. But then what?
Yeah, and you know what? You might think, well, why are we keep talking about Broadway? Not everybody can get there.
Oh, Broadway plays all over the world.
Correct, and I will tell you that you kind of mentioned they need more houses. They need more. That is so true. I was there, this past week on a Thursday night in the middle of December. This is not a high tourist season. Now we're coming up to a high tourist season.
Oh no, it's all. This is high tourist, and anything from Thanksgiving to New Year's is huge for Broadway. Huge.
But I can tell you,
now, this is the biggest 6 weeks of the year.
I have been there though when it hasn't been the biggest 6 weeks of the year in March, in the middle of March, and it is the same darn thing around between 5 and 8 o'clock. You cannot move in Times Square. Oh, well. It is just packed.
Well, more theaters wouldn't change that. It would make it even worse. But I'll tell you what is getting better is the pay for assistants and people who work at low-level positions, including the mailrooms in Hollywood agencies and studios and all this stuff. There's a movement we haven't really talked about called Pay Up Hollywood. And they did a survey of all these people to see what they're making. And they're making nothing. And Verve is one of the first people to step up and say, all right, we are going to pay our assistants and our mailroom livable wages, better wages, because, you know, that's just the only decent thing to do. And if you don't, that means the only people who can accept entry-level positions in Hollywood are people who are already well off. That's just like unpaid internships, which should be illegal, because then you just guarantee only the children of the rich can actually do that, because people got to eat.
You know, when I worked both at William Morris and Creative Artists Agency, and actually some of the other agencies as well that I worked at, I can say at least at CA, when I used to drive my 1973 Dodge Dart Swinger, which was a tank, I might add, when I used to drive it through the parking lot, certainly I was incredibly careful on the upper levels because that is where all of the agents parked.
Do not scratch the Tesla.
Right. Well, there were no Teslas back then. But certainly when I got below a certain, you know, floor level, that's where the assistants parked. I was like, how are you driving a BMW? You earn $20,000 a
Daddy.
Year. Right. And then when you start looking at it, you start going, okay, you're the father, you're the son of this person, the daughter of that person. And you start realizing, Oh, okay. That's how you're doing
it. And that's why you end up with, you know, sexual harassment and no diversity, et cetera, for so many generations, because the only people who can afford to get in there are people who are already well off or plugged in. So
to give you some sense, though, mm-hmm. when I worked there, you pretty much earned $10 an hour.
Oh, okay? That's insane.
Right. And that was in the mid-90s. And, you know, I heard a year or two ago, you know, you pretty much earned about $10 an hour. So 25 years later, still earning the same amount.
That's crazy. So, and my response to all this is it a big deal or a big whoop? I think it's a big whoop because they should be doing it. And if they do it, it's not going to cost them, you know, the moon. It's money. It's real money. But guess what? Their bottom line will be just fine. They just haven't cared. And this is not going to break them. And, you know, slightly less big bonus for the people at the top. They probably won't even bother doing that. But that would be the ultimate, you know, oh, well, that's the biggest hit you have. Oh, instead of, you know, 20 million, you get 18 million or something. This is something they can do. They can afford to do it. They need to do it. And hopefully they'll continue to do so.
Well, TV personality Steve Harvey is doing something. He continues his dominance of new media. Harvey has enjoyed not one, but two hit shows in daytime syndication. He's also had a hit radio show, primetime stints on Celebrity Family Feud, the syndicated Family Feud, best-selling books, and more. Still, Harvey miscalculated when he ended his first daytime talk show to reboot the series with more control and more profits going to himself. Remember, we talked about that. That removed the support of a major backer. So when they launched The Kelly Clarkson Show, Harvey kind of found himself without a home. Well, he's back. That is, Steve Harvey is back. On Facebook, yes, Steve on Watch is the latest platform he plans to conquer with 10 weeks of episodes debuting on Facebook Watch, the platform's new streaming service embedded into its social media juggernaut. So is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, as Karen would say, successful guy gets job. Hello, Karen Woodward. Happy holidays. But anyway, it's, you know, it's a new platform for him. I would never underestimate him, you know, like Ice Cube at movies. I will bankroll his movie every day of the week. Steve Harvey, he's a proven winner in every platform. So I'm assuming this will work and make him money. He loves the instant gratification of it. He has these YouTube clips that bring him six figures right away. He's like, I don't got to wait for it. It's real money right now. And I think he's going to really be into the instant feedback and the instant attention of videos on Facebook Watch. We'll have to see how he does. But, you know, he does. Did we mention? Yeah, he does daytime family. You know, he's got platforms everywhere. His radio seems to have dropped a little bit from what I could gather. He doesn't seem to be in the market in New York anymore. So radio is fading a bit, but he's got a lot on his plate.
What I would say is if you want a good laugh in the English language, for those of you listening in the English language, search up on YouTube the dumbest or stupidest answers ever given on Family Feud. And Steve Harvey, I mean, it goes on, but it's so funny. Some of these answers are just,
that's why they last.
Yes. It's pretty remarkable. Now, speaking of things that last, the Library of Congress announced 25 new films added to the National Registry, bringing the grand total to 775. Among the honorees, Purple Rain, She's Gotta Have It, Old Yeller, The Last Waltz, Disney's Sleeping Beauty, Amadeus, Coal Miner's Daughter, and Clerks. One of these things is not like the other.
What? I didn't think Clerks belongs.
I'm just kidding. While most people have heard of Platoon and Clerks, and even 1944's Gaslight starring Ingrid Bergman, which I assume is among those titles, some titles will be unfamiliar. 1955's noir, The Phoenix City Story, is based on a true story of corruption in a small Alabama town.
Soon to be the Michael Gilt story.
Exactly. There's 1981's Zoot Suit, which is another fact-based work. This one starring Edward James Olmos in the story of Mexican-Americans in Los Angeles rising up in the 1940s after young men are jailed for a murder they did not commit, based on a play, in fact.
Oh.
Big deal or big
deal? I didn't know that. I think this is a big deal. I love this list every year. There's lots of great early clips and fragments of stuff that gets onto the list. There are seven films directed by women. The most recent title is Errol Morris's documentary Fog of War from 2003, which should comfort him after the response to his latest similar film, American Dharma, which is not good. The oldest is footage of emigrants arriving at Ellis Island in 1903. So it's great stuff.
Oh, this next one's a mess.
Oh, you were supposed to ask me which one doesn't deserve to be on the list. I'll tell you, 1944's Gaslight. Yes, the phrase is back in the popular lexicon. Thank you, you know, Republicans, Trump. But that is not a good movie. Gaslight is a lame film. I don't think it has any cultural import. The fact that the phrase Gaslight that existed before the film, you know, it began with the play. But I don't think that qualifies it to be on here. This is not about these being the best films of all time. Purple Rain is flawed, but it has massively awesome, great concert scenes and is a signal film. It has a certain importance. And so that's what we're talking about here. But by any standard, I just don't think Gaslight belongs. I also think it's getting a little, we're up to 775 films. They don't look like they're stretching it yet, but they might want to say maybe we should lower it to 15 or 10. 25 a year is rough.
Oh, I see. Like, basically, just do the ones that deserve it.
Well, yeah, not quality-wise. You didn't deserve it as some cultural impact or import, right? But I think 25 is going to get a little bit too hard. Maybe when they hit 800, they should stop that. Or certainly by the time they hit 1,000, they need to slow down and talk about doing just 10 at a time.
Well, as I was mentioning previously, this next story is a bit of a mess. A Hollywood manager with some big clients has gained fame as a contestant on the CBS reality show Survivor.
Oh, good for him.
Yeah, not by winning, though.
Oh.
Okay, mind you. Yeah, but by becoming the first contestant in history to be booted off the show. Manager Dan Spilo didn't respect the personal space of a female contestant from day one. She complained to producers, but she says little to nothing was ever done about it. It burst into prominence on air when she repeated her complaints, since Spilo continued his actions. That led to an ugly scene where contestants who had previously supported her used the tribal council as an opportunity to position themselves to win. Okay, they were trying to win the show rather than what they knew were valid complaints.
Yeah, you suddenly saw all these people who supported her switch their allegiance and vote and sort of target the people who were complaining. So there sat Dan, free and easy, laughing, while she gets booted off the show. it was ugly.
I'm going to come back to that in a second. Because I know I said we weren't going to get political, but viewers in the meantime were left confused as to all the machinations until Spilo himself was summarily booted for other behavior that took place off camera and which did not include a fellow contestant. Pretty much everything was handled poorly here from start to finish, with longtime fans of the show at Trade Papers saying, "Survivor, it may be broken forever. So is this a big deal or a big whoop?"
Well, I think it's a big whoop. It ain't good for Dan Spilo's career, and he has some big names. I mean, Jared Padalecki's not the biggest, but, he's had a long run on Supernatural, and he's starting, what's the new one? Walker, Texas Ranger. He's got a lot of clients, the company. Bad, bad move. Oh, this is ugly. People are maybe not going to want to be associated with him. This is a big mess. They handled it poorly. But in the scheme of things, it's just reflective of society. The fact that it happened is not any more or less important than any other travesty of justice.
It's so reflective of society.
And CBS.
I'm just going to touch on this for a second. And that is this sentence here, where contestants who had previously supported her used the tribal council, which is where they vote somebody off the island, so to speak, as an opportunity to position themselves to win rather then do what they knew was correct and support valid complaints. Okay, that right now is our political system here in the United States.
Yeah.
That's
politicians
it just goes
like to
show
keep
you,
their job.
Right, and it just goes to show you how, people will turn on, and I'm sure this is like human nature, but it irks me when you're doing something wrong for your own self-benefit, even though it doesn't benefit society at large.
Well, there's actually a lot of human nature, and there's some new good science books talking about how actually generosity and community and looking out for others is actually part of what makes us successful as a species. So don't be bleak and think you got to be out for yourself and screw everybody else. That actually doesn't work once you get beyond a really tiny, tiny group. You need other people to survive. So don't be too bleak.
It's working right now for one person in particular, though.
Keep going.
One of the biggest hits in recent years was the Chinese melodrama The Story of Yangtze Palace. Remember, we used to talk about this all the time.
It's huge.
Yes. It proved a sensation in China, inspiring a fashion wave and yet another peak of interest in the Qing dynasty. And you know what? I wanted to see it. It contained 70 episodes, and it is best described as a telenovela, a show designed to have a beginning and middle and end throughout its run, a la, a miniseries, or in this case, a maxi series with 70 episodes. Ultimately, the government clamped down on the show, seeing it as perhaps a little too popular or too subversive by focusing on the life of royalty or by championing the story of an individual. Whatever the reason, it disappeared from the air after an initial run. Well, that hasn't stopped a sequel from happening. Yangtze Palace, Princess Adventures. It's debuting soon, and in a sign of the times, a U.S. streamer snagged international rights. Michael was frustrated he had no easy access to the original show, as was I. Well, no worries this time out. It's debuting on Netflix on December 31st, before it even debuts in China. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, but it's a sign of the streaming times, isn't it? That's where the action is. And my God, a lot of people in China are going to be signing up for Netflix somehow with some international, you know, they're going to get access somehow.
You know, certainly VPN usage in China is definitely closely monitored. So,
oh, I'm sure. Yes,
our Chinese listeners.
Well, when you're well, be careful. But the original had episodes streamed some 15 billion times on Chinese iQIYI service, if I'm saying that pronouncing that correctly. That's one of their big. What is it?
Qiyi. Yeah.
Producers are still negotiating with broadcasters in the country. And no, it doesn't look like the original series will be coming to Netflix either. I'm sure they would have liked to have done that. And said, hey, we want to air that as well because we figure people want to catch up or, you know, check it out again. But so far, no luck.
So, you know, years from now, it could be the prequel.
Yeah, absolutely.
From America's Got Talent to Survivor to American Gods, people keep speaking out and speaking up. The latest is Orlando Jones, he who we referenced in our kind of opening here. Now, he joined the troubled series American Gods in season 2 playing Mr. Nancy. Jones says he was given the opportunity to write for his own character, along with other characters of color, in the fantasy series. Neil Gaiman himself reached out and encouraged Jones, who expected to come back for season 3, as a writer, a producer, and an actor. Instead, Jones says he was strung along, doing publicity, and not finding out he wasn't coming back until the very last minute. The series has a new showrunner going in another direction entirely, and going in that direction pretty darn fast. Indeed, Jones says the new showrunner felt his take on characters of color was not the right message for Black America. Jones took issue with not being told he wouldn't come back, so Jones could seek other work. That's really the major thing here. He finally spoke up because he feared fans would pay money to get access for the new season before knowing he was gone. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. It's bad for Fremantle, isn't it? It's the same company behind America's Got Talent. And they say, hey, look, American Gods is a hugely diverse series, but they surely did not treat him with respect in terms of, all right, we're not using you. They got a new guy in. Clearly, he wanted a clean deck and refocus it again. And this series has sort of been a mess from the start. But boy, oh boy, did they not do a good job. The news here is that normally you'd shut up. And you would just grumble about it to your friends because you figure if you speak out, you're going to pay a bigger price than if you just shut up because you just have to put up with it. This is how you get treated. This is Hollywood. Maybe I'm just exaggerating because I'm a person of color. Maybe white people get treated. But no, nowadays people are saying, you know what? There's no downside for me to speak up. I'm not making life difficult for anyone. I'm just telling what happened and being honest and straightforward. And that's what Orlando Jones is doing. And you know what? If that creates problems for you, I don't care. And if it creates problems for me, well, I guess I'll have to live with that. But he's saying, no, we're done shutting up and we're done being quiet. And it's a whole, you got to think twice now. You know, you could treat people like dirt, but if the world finds out about it, you know, that can create problems for you. Maybe people won't be as easy or excited to work with you in the future. No?
Yeah, no, I think
that's the real change here. Gabrielle Union gets dumped. She thinks, calculates in the past, well, you know, what can I say or do about it? I'll just get painted as a complainer and a problem. So, well, I'm already painted that way. So what's the downside?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, she may as well, take it to the mat.
Sure. Well, she's winning.
Yeah. Now, it's official, okay? No one buys records or albums. Pretty much the same two things. Anymore. Okay, yes, they buy vinyl, and someone somewhere keeps buying CDs. But by and large, sales of songs and albums are really determined by streaming. If you see a song on the top of the Hot 100, most of the time that means people are streaming it or watching it on YouTube rather than actually buying it. It's the era of consumption, and Billboard magazine knows its charts must reflect that. That's why they've announced that streaming of official videos on sites like YouTube and Apple will be added to its formula for determining the most popular albums in the country. This takes place 5 years after they added streaming to the formula determining the singles chart. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. Remember when Billboard switched to actual sales rather than just reports from people, this is what I think is selling. When they switched to SoundScan, that had a huge impact. Suddenly you saw country albums and gospel albums and rap albums at the top of the charts, where before they would not have made it up there except in very rare situations. That led to Garth Brooks and tons of artists becoming hugely popular because people realized, oh, other people are listening to it. Those charts matter. Well, when they switch this way, this can mean a big boost for Latin and hip hop and electronic music, because those guys are really big on the YouTube charts and other charts, and they're getting tons of play, including music from other parts of the world, not just Central and South America. You can see a real big difference in the songs and albums that pop up onto the top of the charts. But as far as I'm concerned, stop trying to pretend they're sales. Just make it a pure streaming chart, you know? Stop telling me, well, it streamed this much, and so we do carry the X, move the Y. Most of it is streaming, so just give us a streaming chart. Tell us what albums had, I don't know, a 70% of fair amount. That's Netflix rule sticks in my head. But if people play 70% of an album, official tracks, okay, then they've listened to the album once. Do not convert one song played a billion times into album sales. That's ridiculous. Keep that as a big hit song. Tell us this song was streamed 14 billion times last week. The album,
which, by the way, is in and of itself a feat.
Right, of course. Right, but just give us streaming charts. Tell us what they're streaming. Stop pretending that you can convert them magically into sales, and just give us that streaming chart. Have a separate sales chart, because that doesn't matter as much anymore. So your official chart, really, in this world, this day and age, it should be a streaming chart. The vast majority of consumption is via streaming. We look at the album sales and they say, oh, this album sold 30,000 copies. Like, who cares? You know, that is a pittance to what we saw 20 years ago. And streaming is where it's happening. Instead of trying to convert it into something it's not, just tell us the streaming, and just keep album streams separate from single streams. If you don't play most of the album, if an individual on their own Spotify account does not play anything but two or three tracks, they have not streamed that album a single time. But if they play 70% of the album, or whatever you determine is fair, then that's a single listen of the album. And if they play those 70% tracks again and again, well, that's two streams, three streams of the album. It seems pretty simple to me. Give us that. Give us the actual numbers that you're using rather than trying to dance on a pin. You know. And look at this. The era of consumption is clearly here. Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas, because the singles chart has sort of moved more and more towards consumption, that is the number one song in the country. That's the first time it's ever hit the top of the charts after being released 25 years ago. And anybody who's anywhere in the country knows this is absolutely the most streamed, played song in the country right now. It is absolutely All I Want for Christmas. You can't get away from it. It's a standard. They play it every year. And for these few weeks, not a surprise, it'll probably be on the charts again next year. Bing Crosby's White Christmas, way back in 1942, the number one song in the country. Then number one in 1945 and 1946. It returned to the charts for 20 years when they were actually reflecting what songs were being bought and listened to on the radio. And then they just said, let's put it on a separate chart. Let's create a holiday chart. We don't want to have to see Bing Crosby's White Christmas every year in December. Well, why not? That's the most popular song right now.
Didn't they do that for like Harry Potter? They were like, yeah, we're not counting.
Yeah, the New York Times got freaked out because the bookstore said, well, three slots on the chart are taken up by Harry Potter books. This is so unfair. It's ridiculous. Those aren't real books. So they just said, okay, we'll never put kids' books on the charts again. So if Philip Pullman had a breakout book, if Dr. Seuss returns every year, if some new, you know, Chosen's author writes a book that everybody buys tons of copies of, you'll never see it on the New York Times bestseller list ever again. It's like it didn't exist. It's like having a movie chart and saying, well, we're not going to include animation. That's silly. So you'd never see an animated film on the top 10 top grossing movies. So all these things just reflect reality. The Billboard charts and singles are doing a better job. The album charts should stop converting it into sales. There are no sales anymore. Just make a streaming chart. I'm done.
Well, you know, all of that could easily have fit into our Inside Baseball segment. But instead, during Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing, and we explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you, instead of discussing, you know, Billboard charts and music charts, we're going to be discussing the awards season and what that means to some of these films and
our
these nominees.
Advice.
Yeah, okay, so what is our advice and what does it mean? And just fill us in on everything.
Well, costume designers announced their Guild Awards, their nominations for this year, and they named 15 films in three categories: contemporary, period, and the sci-fi fantasy category. That's awesome, but just like the Art Guild and everybody else, they need to choose their favorites. They want to have an impact on the award season. Name your five favorite films of the year, the five best made films, no matter what the genre, contemporary, period, or sci-fi. So if they want to have an impact, it's true, they named 15 films, but they'd have a much bigger impact if they said, beyond those, here's our top prize to the best in any category. Here are the best five films. That would help bring attention to those movies a lot better than what they've done. And the same is true for the Cinema Audio Society. They listed five films in live action, five films in animated, five films in doc, and guess what? Those are five, you know, different categories. The live action, they have announced. They didn't say sci-fi versus period. Versus
you're talking about the Ace Eddie Awards,
that's
right?
The editing. I said did it right. They've got live action films, and they split up animated, and I can understand why, I guess, because that is a separate category, though if it's good enough, it deserves Best Picture. But they named five films in their live action category. They didn't break it up into action and war or sci-fi fantasy or period and contemporary. They just said the five best edited films of the year so far for cinema audio, for audio editing. Those are Ford versus Ferrari, The Irishman, Joker, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and Rocket Man. So they said, hey, we think if when it comes to audio, those are the five best films of the year. And that helps focus people and say, okay, I need to check them out.
Well, the largest voting block for the Oscars, and I know the Oscars isn't everything, but it's the actors, right?
Yeah, that's true, yes.
So the Screen Actors Guild actually had their nominations.
That's right. Well, you're skipping over the Ace Editing Awards. They included five dramas and five comedies in their their list. So they had 10 films, so I guess that's fair enough. And then they had five docs. And then you finally get down to SAG. They're much bigger. They're the biggest block. They're probably one of the best predictors. And they just named five films of the year. Now, unlike the audio guys, I guess they're into audio. So they alphabetized The Irishman under T. For The Irishman. No, guys, ignore the. It's Irishman. That's why you alphabetize. The SAG got it right, because alphabetically, their five best films of the year are Bombshell, The Irishman, Joker, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and...
Oh, I see, you're taking the ... literally.
And okay. Parasite. So they have an international film that's pretty bold for SAG. That doesn't happen a lot. Bombshell, which hasn't even hit theaters yet, so that's exciting. Once Upon a Time, one of the big hits of the summer. Joker, one of the biggest hits of all time. And The Irishman, a Netflix film. So that's an interesting mix of movies.
And Taron Egerton is like, thank you for remembering that I was in Rocket Man.
That's right. Yeah, he's getting a good love, and he's also a great campaigner. He's friendly, he's affable, he's short, he'll sing at the drop of a hat. He's everywhere, charming everybody, so don't be surprised if he's on the list. He is among the side picks for Best Actor, along with Christian Bale for Ford versus Ferrari, Leonardo DiCaprio for Once Upon a Time, Adam Driver for Marriage Story, and Joaquin Phoenix for Joker. Taron Egerton's right in the mix there.
Now, I would say, you know, I don't think that Taron Egerton's height has anything to do with his ability to win or not win any awards.
Well, you know, actors tend to be on the shorter side. So, you know what? If you're thinking about all the other actors who aren't that tall, who like people like that, you're like, hey, he's one of us. So it can't hurt.
You know, I'm tempted to say the next group of people we're going to talk about aren't tall at all anymore.
Well, I guess you're not talking about best actress.
No. I was going to talk about people like actress Anna Karina.
Oh, we moved on from, that's right. I will say one thing about the SAG Awards. You look at Netflix dominating the awards season. I would bet money they'll have three films on the best movies of the year list. I think they're going to have three films at least. They could have
best picture, you mean?
Yeah, for best picture. And you look at broadcast TV, the SAG Awards, they were almost completely shut out of TV nominations, including like acting. You know, I mean, they just don't even exist anymore. So that is a big change when it comes to award season. Netflix and streamers are right in there, and broadcast TV is slipping away. And so are these people that you've mentioned, like New Wave star Anna Karina. She died at 79. Did you love her, Sperling?
I loved her. I didn't know necessarily who she was, but I'm sure I would have loved her.
Oh, well, she's a, you know, they call her a muse of Godard, but to me that sounds a little infantilizing, like she just stands there and looks pretty. She's an incredibly talented actress. She appeared in great films by a lot of major filmmakers. She certainly married Godard for a number of years and starred in some of his key films like A Woman is a Woman, band of outsiders and Alphaville, but she also...
Oh, I do know who she is. Oh, yes.
She's the face of the new wave. I mean, she's just a terrific actress. She also starred in films by Jacques Rivette, Visconti, Fassbinder, Chris Marker, Volker Schlondorf. You know, she did it all.
Well, also passing away, it was Richard Easton who died at the age of 86. He is a Tony winner.
That's right.
A Broadway Tony winner.
Yeah, I saw him in The Invention of Love and The Coast of Utopia. Both Tom Stoppard plays The Coast of Utopia, being a massive three-part. What am I talking about? Just a monster of a play. You see someone on stage like that, you feel such a link and a connection to him. Most people probably have never even heard of him, but he was a great actor. He collapsed on stage, made a comeback. For his last few years. So just someone you feel like you know because you've seen him over the years for 20, 30 years, giving one great performance after another. He had a good long career as opposed to Korean actor Cha In-ha, who died at 27. Another sad story from Korea. The K-pop star Klang Daniel posted a cry for help online and said, "Someone, please save me. Everything is too difficult. Good God." And thankfully, people reached out, he reached out, and this 22-year-old was open and upfront saying, look, he's taking a break, he's going to get medical help, he's going to enter psychotherapy, he's getting medicine for mental health issues, which is something that not a lot of people talk about anywhere, but certainly the stigma is very great in Korea as well. It's very rare there where health issues are talked about, and they're just as stigmatized as they are in the U.S. or anywhere else, but it seems to be a really big problem there. On the same day that this actor, this K-pop star, spoke out and got help and was honest and open about what he's doing, sadly, Korean actor Cha In-ha was found dead in his home. We think he died by suicide. Korea, as we've mentioned recently, has one of the highest suicide rates per capita in the world. So,
wow, I did not know that.
Well, you were wondering what the heck is going on here. That is, you know, it's a country where there's a huge problem with suicide. So hopefully... it's sad to hear these people who are in this public spotlight dealing with this and dying, but hopefully that will help break through the logjam and get people to talk about this more commonly and openly and talk about getting help and can hopefully reverse this horrible plague that they have right now.
Well, also dying at the age of 86 was Danny Aiello. Now, he is an actor who was basically a union organizer, actually. And was a Greyhound bus driver and only began acting at the age of 35, then had a stupendous career. He did everything from, I guess he started off slowly with Bang the Drum, no pun intended, yeah. Bang the Drum Slowly, and a small part in Godfather Part II. He was in three Woody Allen films, including Radio Days. Then maybe most memorably in Moonstruck and most definitely, Do the Right Thing.
Yes, that's some classic films there. He was in one of my favorite Woody Allen films, The Purple Rose of Cairo. He was the abusive husband of Mia Farrow, and then Do the Right Thing and Moonstruck. The 80s were really his salad days. But he loved to sing, and he had an Italian restaurant, and every once in a while he'd get good press. You know, he had a good publicist who got him, oh, Tony Aiello burst into song. You know, he just would do it at the drop of a hat. But affable guy who had a good run in his career and made some great films.
Well, we're not going to burst into song, but well, that's true. That's why I'm trying to get us out of here.
Sperling, all I want for Christmas is you.
Wait a second. I think you just helped
boost it up another.
Yeah, exactly. Now, what I was going to say was that you can subscribe to us in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher. I did get an email from Spotify, so perhaps even Spotify. But do please subscribe to the show, rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It helps us out when you do. Links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find all those ways to subscribe to us or even write to us. Dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're on Twitter, where our handle is at Showbiz Sandbox, or you can, find us on Facebook. Facebook.com/Showbiz Sandbox is where you can like our page. All of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. It's by the popular indie rock group MGMT. Their website is whoismgmt.com. You see how that's confusing?
I do.
Michael Gilts has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's shepherdwithoutasheep.com.
I kind of like that, and I bet you it's taken.
See how I switched that around?
Yes, I like that. Yes, actually, that might not be taken. But you know what? If you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgilts.com, where all of his work can be found. Some of my work can be found on Celluloid Junkie. Until next week, play nice.